Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, some positive motion from a normally stalemated Congress. The Senate voted to approve $2 billion in additional money for the National Institute of Health, specifically to increase research money for Alzheimer's disease and precision medicine.
Well, that's the second year in a row that Congress has increased funding to the NIH. They had seen a steady decline in funding for the past 10 years, and that put a lot of long-term research protocols in jeopardy.
As NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins told us, without that funding, the U.S. was bound to lose its edge in leading the world in medical research. It's certainly a step in the right direction, Margaret.
Well, in addition to $1.4 billion for Alzheimer's research, another $300 million is being earmarked for the President's Precision Medicine Initiative. This seeks to advance the research of genomics and other emerging disciplines that are going to make the treatment of disease a more personalized approach, tailoring treatments to each individual's genetic profile. That's really about launching medicine into the new frontier, but that's not going to happen without considerable resources, Mark. So you're right, great step in the right direction.
Affording that specialized care for the average individual, however, is still a great concern. The cost of health care is continuing to rise, and increasingly it's pricing many American health consumers out of accessing necessary care, something our guest today is quite focused in on.
Lynn Quincy is a longtime senior researcher at Consumers Union. That's the consumer watchdog agency that's focused on ensuring that American consumers are getting the products they're paying for and that those products don't cause them harm. And that's a tall order in healthcare, unfortunately.
Consumer Union and others have done an in-depth study on the problem of skyrocketing healthcare costs for consumers with high deductible health plans. A growing concern is many consumers are finding it increasingly difficult to afford out-of-pocket costs for healthcare services.
And they're also focused on the extremely high rate of medical errors, which lead to an estimated 400,000 deaths per year, as we've talked about other times on the show. That's now recognized as the third leading cause of death in this country, and that's just got to be stopped. Lynn Quincy will be talking about the new venture they've launched at Consumers Union, the Healthcare Value Hub. It's aimed at helping consumers get the best value from their healthcare purchases and get better care as well. So we look forward to that conversation.
Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter. We love hearing from you. Now let's get to our interview with Lynn Quincy in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Senate panel responsible for approving health care spending bills has reached a bipartisan agreement on spending requests, including $1.4 billion for Alzheimer's research and $300 million for the president's Precision Medicine Initiative. The president had also requested additional funds for confronting the nation's opioid addiction crisis. $262 million for the CDC's prescription drug overdose program, also approved, as well as money for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Senate Democrats had asked for $600 million to confront the crisis, which has led to 28,000 overdose deaths in 2014 alone. Republicans rejected that bill. Meanwhile, while state health plans are supposed to cover addiction recovery services for all customers as an essential benefit, an independent analysis of these plans shows two-thirds of them across the country fall far short. The National Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse analyzed addiction treatment services required in the 2017 Essential Health Benefits Benchmark Plans and found none offered any kind of comprehensive offerings for addiction services. The report found these services were frequently excluded from overall coverage. On the other hand, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, coverage for mental health services has increased, more patients seeking behavioral health care services than before. Ah, summertime, that time when you wander out of doors through nature and find yourselves checking for ticks at the end of the day. It's the ones you miss that cause the big problems, though. The Tony New England island of Nantucket is entertaining a novel approach. 40% of the island's residents have contracted Lyme disease in recent years, due partially to a large deer population. But an MIT scientist has crafted an interesting approach, genetically modified mice that are resistant to the bacteria that causes Lyme infection. Mice are further down the tick food chain, but are a vital link to the spreading of the disease. The scientist proposes testing the release of these mice in a smaller uninhabited island first to see if it works before releasing the genetically altered mice on the main island. The trick will be to find that Lyme-resistant gene and breed enough mice with this trait to scale up the project and the effect. And mosquitoes carrying malaria continue their deadly march across significant parts of the world, leading to about 700,000 deaths worldwide each year. A commitment from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as the Obama administration, is seeking to eradicate malaria by the year 2040. It's going to take a concerted effort. They're lending their resources towards a number of initiatives, including creating new insecticides that mosquitoes can't develop a resistance to, creating new building materials that come with a mosquito repellent in them, working on a vaccine and creating a one-dose treatment that would immediately kill all the parasites in the body. Genetically modified mosquitoes are also on the list of possibilities, an approach that's being considered to fight the spread of the Zika virus as well. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub at Consumers Union, the policy and advocacy organization, longtime publisher of Consumer Reports, which provides unbiased information on consumer products, including in healthcare. Ms. Quincy served as senior health policy analyst at Consumer Union, testing the new health insurance disclosure form and tax credit explainers, and advocating for better health insurance literacy strategies. Prior to joining Consumer Union, she was the senior researcher at Mathematica Policy Research, Inc. Ms. Quincy also held senior positions with the Institute for Health Policy Solution and with Watson Wyatt Worldwide. She holds a master's degree in economics from the University of Maryland. Lynn, welcome back to Conversations in Healthcare.
I'm very pleased to be with you.
Yeah, it's been 4 years. A world has gone by. I mean, my God, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. But before the insurance marketplace's plans had been developed, you offered some research and analysis to support the creation of consumer-friendly products for consumers to access online as well as to utilize to their best advantage. And you had 4 years now to gather a lot of data in the insurance marketplaces, and I'm wondering how those plans lived up to your expectations and what we might learn from the work you've done.
Well, I'm very pleased to report that I think this is mostly a good news story. Looking broadly just for a moment, we have 20 million people now newly insured through the various aspects of Obamacare, including Medicaid, the marketplaces that we're going to talk about, and allowing young adults to stay on their parents' coverage. And that's a huge accomplishment, and there have been some recent studies that have conclusively documented the link between having coverage and having better health. So it's just worth pausing on that for a moment.
Yes.
Coming back to the marketplaces specifically, we have seen a lot of progress since the poor launch that frustrated so many consumers and I think is still perhaps their dominant impression of how these marketplaces are going to work. For several years now, things have been working very smoothly, and they're also doing a lot, both at the in the state marketplaces and the federal marketplaces, to make the consumer experience better and make it easier for them to reliably distinguish from among plans. There's no reason to think it won't actually continue to get better. They're looking at increasing the prevalence of something called a standard plan design, which would mean cost sharing wouldn't vary so much across products, and that would make it easier to compare different plans.
Well, that is very exciting. And I want to talk for a moment about a perhaps less exciting element of the whole issue of insurance for all Americans. And that's a new consumer experience brought to us by the Affordable Care Act, the tax forms that consumers now have to file in order to obtain the subsidies that underwrite the cost of purchasing mandated health coverage. Tell us how that experience is playing out for the American health consumer and what have been the biggest challenges for taxpayers.
Well, I'm a Pollyanna. I actually think this is a good news story as
well.
Excellent. We like this.
That.
the tax credits are crucial to getting the new coverage. Over 80% of those enrolling through the marketplace use these credits, and on average, they're covering 3/4 of the premium. So they're really bringing down the cost of getting insurance coverage, and that's a huge reason why we have people in insurance that otherwise wouldn't be. Now, the bad news story is that researchers estimate that only 50% of those who are eligible for these tax credits are actually applying for them. So there's a lot of people out there who could be getting a lower cost insurance coverage but aren't for some reason. Now, this is new with Obamacare, and it is a tax credit, which means you are dealing with tax forms. Some of the biggest headaches that consumers are facing is that they have to document their income because it is, you do have to show how much you earn. And I think what becomes particularly hard is when someone has an income that fluctuates a lot during the year. Maybe they're self-employed and it's very hard to predict what their income will be. But on the whole, it is a good news story because they're very generous and they make coverage available to people when it otherwise might be financially out of reach.
Lynn, you've taken on a new role at Consumer Union as director of the recently launched Healthcare Value Hub, a new center that helps advocates and others address high healthcare costs, lack of transparency, and uneven quality. Healthcare costs continue to rise more than we want them to, though I'd say in the last 5 years they've been lower than they have historically, but they've been higher than people's salaries have gone. And it's brought a lot of consumers to the table. But how do we address, you know, multi-trillion dollar question of controlling the cost of healthcare? Any good news there?
The issue of healthcare spending that increases at a rate that far exceeds the general rate of economic growth, far exceeds the rate of wage increases, this is a problem. It's been with us for over 20 years. But we haven't yet systematically as a nation addressed this issue, and it's past time to do that. And it's a big initiative here at Consumer Reports because it is not sustainable, and it causes so much financial distress for both consumers and businesses and state governments, crowding out dollars they need for their other programs. I think that this is an addressable problem, but it is a little bit of a long game. We have a bias in this country to thinking that the marketplace is going to solve our problems. Mm-hmm. But when you really, researchers have taken a hard look at that presumption when it comes to healthcare prices and how healthcare resources are allocated, and the market actually does a terrible job of pricing things appropriately, of ensuring you have the resources that you need, of controlling for quality. So we have to, I think, bring a sort of market and regulatory approach to this problem, and we're just beginning to own up to that fact. But we have some work to do in terms of coming together as a nation to actually enact those solutions.
Well, Lynn, one of the areas that you're focused on at the Healthcare Value Hub is the lack of price transparency. And maybe that's changing somewhat under the ACA, but drug costs, something that actually most Americans deal with regularly as opposed to hospitalization, are really crippling consumers in some cases. And we've seen this fairly recent but very dramatic trend of just outrageous price increases for some of the most common drugs and what we used to think of as cheap drugs on the market. Maybe you could talk with us about this lack of price transparency, particularly for pharmaceuticals, but certainly for ambulatory, hospital, or diagnostic care as well. How are you focused on improving transparency for the consumer in this area, and what can consumers do to get a better value for their drug and other healthcare purchases?
So this is a really important question. Price transparency across the board is a crucial leg of this effort to address high healthcare spending, because right now prices are very opaque, not just for drugs, but for everything. We have this great graphic. We call it the drug pricing supply chain. And it shows how convoluted and hidden these various prices are. There is a list price that's publicly published, but that's not the price anybody pays. That we have discounts and other things applied to that price, and then the final price is actually hidden. And there are a lot of efforts around the country to expose that prices, expose sort of a do a price justification, where not only do we learn what the true price is, but what led to that price. In the case of drugs, we had to do that through congressional investigations, journalistic investigations, and that shouldn't be how we get information about what the prices are for our crucial healthcare products that we need. It needs to be a much more routine and reliable approach to getting to price transparency. This is a important initiative that's part of our work on healthcare costs. We're working on that at the state level and when the opportunity presents itself at the federal level. But I actually think we'll make progress at the state level before the federal.
We're speaking today with Lynn Quincy, Director of Healthcare Value Hub at Consumer Union, the policy and advocacy organization, longtime publisher of Consumer Reports, dedicated to providing unbiased information on consumer products, including in healthcare. Lynn, I was thinking as you were talking about price transparency, we had Stephen Brill on, Margaret, a while ago talking about this, and certainly there have been a lot of advocates. But, you know, I want to talk about another transparency issue that's truly deadly consequence. And a recently released report placed medical mistakes and errors as the third leading cause of death in this country. And, you know, we just had Toby Cosgrove on from the Cleveland Clinic, who really made a concerted effort to be as transparent on all of these. But it is a profound problem within the healthcare system. And you recently filed a report on the scope of the problem. And your analysis counted more than 400,000 deaths per year. Talk to our listeners about your report and how do we address this issue of transparency in this particular area.
It does not seem to be widely understood that the quality of care provided by hospitals is actually very uneven. People have a perception that we have the best health care in the world, and sometimes that's true for certain segments of care, you know, highly technological care that we provide. But in other ways, it is not true. We have a graphic that shows that deaths from hospital-acquired infections, and that's just one type of medical harm, exceeds the deaths from drunk driving 7-1. And that's shocking for people because they think of deaths from drunk driving as being so very high. The report that you referenced is we didn't do our own assessment of how often these various forms of medical harm occur. I think the reasons that this conversation doesn't happen often enough is that people are confused about the various forms of medical harm. How is a hospital-acquired infection different from a hospital-acquired condition? And so the report was designed to provide a taxonomy so we could understand the forms of medical harm. We looked to see what information existed that showed for each of these types of medical harm, how often did they occur? And the big thing about that table is how many holes there are in it, how often we don't know how often medical harm occurs. So, for example, diagnostic errors are very rarely counted. When it comes to getting more transparent, this is hard. We need to do it, but it's a delicate balancing act because we would like reliable, timely data, but of course it's not in the hospital's interest to report it reliably because they could possibly look bad. And I would really like to congratulate the hospitals that have bravely taken the step of regular public reporting of hospital infections. And so we need to figure out how to encourage them to report reliably, get them to correct where corrections are needed without penalizing them so much that they fail to report or they hide these rates of infections.
Well, Lynn, while more Americans have health insurance than ever before, many are still putting off accessing health services they really need because the deductibles on their plans are just so high. And the good news has been, of course, also that preventive services are available with regardless of deductibles. But other health services, those deductibles can be very high. And, you know, certainly we've seen some of the most popular plans offered by the insurance companies are associated with very high out-of-pocket costs or high deductibles to the consumer who then finds they simply can't afford to go and get health care. You're quite concerned about this trend, so perhaps you can share your analysis of this issue with us.
We really face a crisis in terms of high rates of healthcare spending. And a huge way in which industry has responded to this crisis is to make high deductible health plans more and more prevalent. And these plans are justified by saying that if we give consumers skin in the game, and I do not like that phrase, but by making them pay out of their own pocket, they can put pressure on the marketplace. The hope is that they'll become these very smart shoppers, and that will put pressure on providers to provide a better value, to price their products competitively, and so on. Our report looked at across a whole bunch of new research that shows this is not how it plays out. In reality, consumers aren't armed to do price shopping, and in fact, they're often not inclined to do price shopping. They have other considerations in mind. The system isn't set up to allow them to do price shopping. And they're very confused by cost sharing and when it applies and when it doesn't. And unfortunately, when they face a high deductible health plan, even though these primary preventive care services are free, consumers don't realize that. And they even cut back when they're faced with a high deductible. They cut back on high value services such as that. So we concluded it's time to stop placing the burden on consumer and pretending that they're going to solve a problem that really should be solved by other actors in our system. We need to replace high deductible health plans with more consumer-friendly benefit design so they do go and get the care they need. And we need to attack the problem of high prices from the other direction. We need to go directly to providers. Evidence is growing very strong about different new ways of paying providers to ensure that we get better value from them. So high deductible health plans overpromise, and it's time to replace them with something else.
You know, Lynn, consumers out there probably have two things on their mind. One is, what are you working on right now that will protect them against predatory pricing and outcomes? But also, what can they do themselves to ensure they receive the best value and the best quality care?
Believe it or not, the first thing I'm going to say is that consumers should get mad. We've done a lot of focus group work with consumers, and they start with the assumption that these high healthcare costs is like the weather. There's nothing they can do about it. But there are things we can do about it, and we shouldn't have to live with it. So the first thing I would do is get mad and put pressure on policymakers and regulators to be part of the solution. What can they do within their own world to be able to afford coverage and be able to afford health care? Well, one of the first things they should do is try to stay healthy. That will make them have better quality of life and reduce their costs. And they can do some of the ways they can do that is by getting the word out about these free preventive services. So there's not an affordability barrier. You can go and get these preventive services. And if they face if they need health care and they can't afford it, don't put it off so that the problem gets worse, but instead ask for financial help. If you haven't yet explored the availability of financial help in terms of getting health coverage through the exchanges, explore that. If you're seeking hospital care but worried that you won't be able to afford it, a lot of hospitals have charity care policies or payment plans. And they should always ask for the best deal they can get from the hospital. When there's things that consumers can do when they're choosing health insurance to get a consumer-friendly plan design. They can ensure that the drugs they take are covered by the plan and the providers that they use regularly are in the plan's network. All of those things will help keep their costs down. And finally, if they receive a high bill or an unexpected bill or a price that seems wildly out of line, they should complain to their local insurance regulator. And I can send a link in that shows many people don't realize they have someone in the state that regulates insurance. And we have a little tool that helps get you to the right regulator in your state.
We've been speaking today with Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub at Consumers Union, the policy and advocacy arm and longtime publisher of Consumer Reports. You can learn more and access all of their reports by going to healthcarevaluehub.org, and you can follow her on Twitter at Lynn Quincy. Lynn, thank you so much for the work you do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I was very pleased to be able to join.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
At a congressional hearing on the impact of environmental regulations on farming, Representative Steve King of Iowa underestimated what scientists know about the relationship between farming practices and water quality. King said scientists don't know about the quality of water in the U.S. when the buffalo roamed, technically that would be bison, because there were no water quality tests then. Pre-1900 water quality data are relatively scarce, but experts can use sediment cores from water bodies to evaluate past water quality. King also implied that this lack of baseline data prevents scientists from knowing whether applications of crop fertilizer are too much. But experts say they don't need 19th century data to know fertilizers have negatively impacted water quality. The 20th century provides plenty of evidence. There was water quality monitoring in the 1800s. For instance, chemists developed methods for evaluating water pollution from sewage in response to outbreaks of cholera and typhoid fever. And in the late 1800s, Massachusetts carried out what's been called the Great Sanitation Survey, with more than 40,000 water samples collected. But by that point, humans already had drastically reduced bison numbers. However, scientists can use sediment cores from water bodies to evaluate the water quality of the past. It's like a historical record of water quality, one expert told us. In modern times, water quality monitoring increased substantially in the 20th century, especially after the Clean Water Act passed in 1972. And many reports and papers have concluded that 20th century crop fertilizer use, combined with soil erosion from farming and other factors, has negatively impacted water quality in the U.S. As one expert told us, we don't have to go back to the time of the bison to see changes in water quality due to nitrate pollution. Poor water quality creates issues for both humans and wildlife, such as blue baby syndrome and an explosive growth of algae that reduces oxygen in water. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. According to the World Health Organization, some 35 million people suffer from some form of dementia, and 65 million people are expected to develop dementia by the year 2030, with relatively few treatments available and still no cure on the horizon. Often when cases become more advanced, patients are unable to live on their own. They may be in nursing homes, may be sedated. But studies show those dementia patients who remain more active, who stay outside the clinical setting, are more likely to have a much better quality of life. And that's the basis for a first-of-its-kind dementia village in the Netherlands, built in a small town outside of Amsterdam. Hogeve, an enclosed village built to look and feel exactly like a normal village, but designed to house patients with advanced dementia.
I think one of the things that are very important to people with dementia is that they don't understand what's happening around them. They don't understand the world anymore. We try to help people understand what's happening and let them feel that it's okay.
Co-founder Yvonne van Amerongen says these patients have lost their ability to process new surroundings, and the enclosed village provides a safe and pleasant environment for them to live, where they can walk, socialize, remain engaged. The village was built on 4 acres with 23 connected housing units where patients are grouped based on their earlier personal lifestyles, whether it was based on interest in the arts or music, academics, gardening, and all living areas are manned 24/7 with trained clinicians who help to maintain a sense of normalcy as well as safety. And the director says it ensures that they maintain social connections.
Those people you live with should be people that could be your friends, people you would pick to live with. Those people probably have the same ideas on life. the same values, and we call that lifestyles.
Residents are free to walk throughout the compound. There are stores to shop in, restaurants to dine in, and a theater for performances and daily presentations. And the director says, relatively no need for excess medications or restraints that are so commonly used in dementia wards in so many nursing homes around the globe. The village is neat and orderly, easily navigable and pleasant. In a way, some have compared it to the movie The Truman Show. But the village co-founder says it's necessary to maintain a predictable routine. A planned enclosed residential community designed to maximize quality of life for dementia patients, allowing a communal living experience that feels as close to normal as possible, creating a life with dignity for patients who might ordinarily be institutionalized, sedated, or restrained. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.